thank you. As I've tried to convey by my pathetic attempt to recreate 70s album art, this talk's going to be retro to the point of backwards. It's also going to be low tech. Here's the question I'm interested in. It's a question about the thermodynamic limit, in this case of quantum statistical mechanics. So the situation is you're doing some statistical mechanics. Base case is you're considering the bulk system of interest to be constituted by a finite number of microsystems. You do what you can with it. And one thing you might want to do with it is let the number of microsystems and the volume they occupy go to infinity while keeping their density finite. You might want to take the thermodynamic limit. And the question I'm interested in is, when you take the thermodynamic limit, does anything noteworthy happen? Is there anything noteworthy about the thermodynamic limit? Some prominent philosophers of physics, including Jeremy Butterfield, have argued, nothing especially noteworthy about the thermodynamic limit. Another kind of question I'm interested in is, should people like us, people interested in foundational matters, pay the thermodynamic limit any mind? Other prominent philosophers of physics, Craig Callender, John Ehrman, who's the teacher of about five people in this room, said no. Nobody should pay that much attention to the thermodynamic limit because we all know actual steaming cups of coffee are finite. The thermodynamic limit involves a rank idealization that compromises any lessons you might be tempted to draw from it. So what I want to do today is sort of take on this strand of conventional wisdom among philosophers. I want to suggest there's something at least sort of interesting about what happens at the thermodynamic limit. Whether you want to label it emergence or not, emergence as many things to many people. I'm not sure emergence is the best word for it, but I'm going to try to describe something that seems to me sort of interesting that happens at the thermodynamic limit. And with respect to the second question, should we remark this, make a big deal out of it in our foundational pursuits? I'm going to say, I don't really know what the answer to that question is, but neither do Craig Callender or John Ehrman. And I'm going to close by giving some reasons to say, we're both guessing, but giving some reasons to think my guess is better than theirs. So that's the plan. So here's a kind of creation myth for quantum theory. This is one way you come about a quantum theory. You start with some canonical relations, anti-commutation relations, commutation relations, and you find a Hilbert space representation of them. You find operators acting on a Hilbert space to satisfy them. Your job as a physicist isn't done there. You haven't really got an interesting physical theory unless you've got some sort of nomic relations, functional relations, observable stand-ins. So one way to use your canonical magnitudes to build more magnitudes is to take linear combinations. So you might want to make a kinetic energy term or a configuration-dependent momentum out of your P's and Q's. You might want to add them to make a Hamiltonian. Another thing you might want to do is use the canonical magnitudes to generate their polynomials. Take limit points. Add to your collection of interesting physical magnitudes every magnitude that can be attained at the limit of things already in the collection. Now, seems like a pretty good way to pursue physics. This is like a pretty good way to constitute a large enough collection of magnitudes to frame interesting physical theories. Build good models. What you've done, if you follow this procedure, is you've built an algebra of observables. Just what an algebra is, something. Yeah, sorry. That says you've built an algebra of observables. You can, but then there's a glare problem. I'm going to say I'm going to speak the missing words. Yeah, the algebra of observables tells you what your magnitudes are and how they're related to one another. I'm going to keep talking while I... But a further thing you're interested in, as somebody trying to do physics, somebody trying to marshal the resources of your theory to model things, predict things, explain things, is what are possible physical conditions of the system to which these magnitudes appear? What are possible states of the system? If you impose sanity criteria on your account of states, thinking of a state as a map from elements from the algebra of observables to complex numbers where the self-adjoint elements get mapped to their expectation values, there's certain very natural desiderata you might demand states satisfy. Maybe, normed, positive, Condorcet additive. So once you start with your CARs and get your algebra and impose your sanity criteria for states, you end up with a picture of what the possibilities are for the system at issue and how those possibilities are structured. You wind up with, I'm calling it, a sort of kinematic framework for your quantum theory. This is glare. Yeah, let's
these on.
Yeah, so turn off the overhead ones. And while we're getting these freaky special effects, I'm going to say the thing that's sort of interesting, I think, happens with the thermodynamic limit is part of how physical theories tell you what kinds of objects they're about is by giving you state spaces and magnitudes pertaining to the objects. Like the difference between fermions and bosons is fermions live in a Spock space of anti-symmetric states, bosons symmetric states. The difference between classical system and a quantum system is partly that a classical system lives in a phase space that if it's traveling on the real line is like the real plane. Quantum systems live in Hilbert spaces of possible states. So part of what I think is interesting is when you go to the thermodynamic limit, the story about the kind of system you're studying afforded by the results of following this procedure changes. And maybe you want to call that emergence. Maybe a good name for what happens when you aggregate descriptions of something in such a way that the upshot is the aggregate description tells a different story about what kind of thing the thing you're describing is. Maybe that's one thing emergence might be. Okay, so in a bit more detail, I'm going to consider quantum theory for a finite spin chain, so short of the thermodynamic limit, take this set of spins to be at a one-dimensional lattice centered at zero to make things work out nice later on. What's the first thing you're going to do to build a quantum theory of the system? You're going to find a representation of the Pauli relations for the system. So a trio of spins that's associated with each site, spins associated with different sites commute, and spins at each site satisfy the Pauli relations. And then you carry on as usual. Having found a Hilbert space representation of the canonical relations, you build more observables from the canonical observables by taking linear combinations. You thereby generate an algebra of observables. You impose sanity criteria for what a quantum state is. And you wind up with observable algebra that turns out to be the full collection of bounded operators on the Hilbert space bearing your representation, and quantum states in the familiar form of density operators on that same Hilbert space. And a theorem, the Jordan-Wigner theorem, that says there's really only one way to do this for the finite spin chain. That if two of us go off and come back with things that look like different realizations of the quantum theory in question, they're really just notational variants. There's a, okay, so the story, and you're talking about the finite spin chain, is once you've got canonical commutation or anti-commutation relations, you're sentenced to a quantum theory. There's no choice. You're stuck with this as your quantum theory. There's no other way to go. And the difference I'm going to try to describe that becomes available at the thermodynamic limit when you're talking about an infinite spin chain is the sentence is lifted. The commutation relations, they constrain how you can do physics. Maybe they circumscribe a set of options you can navigate through when you're doing physics. But the theory of physics you wind up with is much more open-ended, much less fixed by the canonical relations themselves than in the finite case. And here, sort of briefly, is why. To build a theory of the infinite spin chain, just find a representation of the Pauli relations, only this time it's a doubly infinite lattice you're assigning the trio of spins to. But as you go through the process of building your quantum theory in the thermodynamic limit, you encounter a question without analog when you're talking about only finitely many spins. And the question concerns observables like this one. This guy here, he's like the average magnetization over a finite length of chain centered at zero. So he's just the average over the z component spins of spins on a finite chunk of chain centered at zero. And this guy, he's a perfectly good observable. He's just a linear combination of canonical observables. You can't get more golden than that. But what about in the thermodynamic limit? What about this guy, what if you wanted to care about, wanted to ask questions about, wanted to deploy as an interesting physical magnitude in explanations and models, the magnetization of the whole thing? Well, then the natural way to define a magnetization magnitude for the whole chain is to just take the limit as n goes to infinity of the finite chain magnetization observables. Okay. But here, there's a bit of a subtlety, which is in order for this to be an observable, the limit has to be well-defined. We can't just say, because there's a sequence that it converges. We need some story about what convergence amounts to, and we need this thing to satisfy that story. So we only get to have a magnetization observable if the limit that would define the magnetization observable exists. And here the question is, we know perfectly well what it is for sequence of numbers have a limit for sequence of numbers to converge. This isn't a sequence of numbers. This is a sequence of Hilbert space operators. So we need some sort of account of what it is for a sequence of Hilbert space operators to converge to a limit. But that's not a problem. Hilbert spaces, they are very eager to give you stories about convergence, stories in the form of operator topologies. I'll go through this quickly because it's probably familiar. So there's a number of different stories that Hilbert space gives you about what it is for a sequence of operators to converge. One is the story afforded by the uniform topology, where a sequence A sub n converges to a putative limit A if and only if the biggest difference between A sub n and A according to any normed vector in the Hilbert space disappears as n goes to infinity. It's a uniform account of convergence. Here's another account of convergence. It's pointwise or weak convergence. The sequence A sub n converges to an element A if and only if, according to each vector in the Hilbert space, the difference between A sub n and putative limit point A disappears as n goes to infinity. Those look like they might be found different accounts of what it is for sequences to converge. And indeed, they do. If your Hilbert space is infinite in dimension, the sequence over the let P sub A be an infinite countable set of pairwise orthogonal projection operators. This guy, the thing, sum over the index set of guys in that set, as n goes to infinity, it doesn't converge in the norm topology, in the uniform topology, it does converge weakly to the identity operator. So they really are different accounts of convergence. Okay, back to our attempt to decide whether or not this global magnetization is really an observable or not. Here are a picture of three different physicists. You can't see them all because one of them is blue. They've been given this assignment, build a quantum theory of the infinite spin chain. They all have the same basic idea about how to do it. Their basic idea is to represent the Pauli relations on a Hilbert space whose basis is afforded by a set of simultaneous eigenstates of spin z. So Paul's idea is his Hilbert space is going to be spanned by the following eigenbasis, a basis vector that assigns spin z up to each lattice site, and then a collection of countable collection of basis vectors that differs from this sort of base basis vector in finitely many places. Why are we limiting the bases to that one up there and ones that differ in only finitely many places? Because we want our Hilbert space to be separable. If we let our Hilbert space, if we let our basis consist of every possible map from the positive and negative integers to plus one, minus one, we wind up with an uncountable basis. And we don't like doing physics in non-separable Hilbert spaces. Okay, so that's Paul's idea. That's his basis. You know how spin z works on that basis, so you get the rest from that. Mary has a very similar idea, only her basis vector, her base basis vector is one that assigns spin down to every lattice site. And her Hilbert space is spanned by a basis consisting of that guy and vectors that differ from it in finitely many places. The physicist Mr. Ed, because he had a bad experience with a horseshoe magnet, he's got the same idea, but his basis vector is going to be this kind of tricky one. It's one guy spin down, then two guys on either side are spin up, then four guys on either side are spin down. It's going to be a basis vector where you're not going to get that global magnetization to behave. It's going to oscillate as you move further and further out. Three different ways, perfectly defensible ways, to straightforwardly following the prescription, build a quantum theory for the infinite spin chain. And then here are some facts. This finite chain magnetization, the thing in the infinite limit, would tell you what the magnetization of the whole chain is. There it is. It doesn't have a uniform limit for any of these physicists. It doesn't converge uniformly for any of these physicists. For Paul, it does converge weakly. In fact, it converges weakly to the identity operator on the Hilbert space carrying his representation. Same song for Mary. It converges weakly, nice, well-defined global magnetization observable. But in her case, it converges weakly to minus one times the identity operator Hilbert space. And then for the physicist Mr. Ed, because his base state was so perverse, the magnetization doesn't converge there's no such thing as global magnetization. It's not well enough behaved as you travel out further and further on the chain for the limit as n goes to infinity of the average over 2n plus 1 sites to converge. Okay.
You're saying it converges on this one state?
It converges for Paul and Mary for every state. I mean, that's what it is to weakly converge according to every state on the Hilbert space. It converges. It doesn't converge weakly for Ed because his Hilbert space is full of states where it doesn't converge, just because if you think about how he set up his vector here, the average magnetization is going to flip-flop. Oh, sorry. This is one state. It's kind of the breeder state for the basis of his Hilbert space. So his Hilbert space is spanned by a state that's spin up everywhere, and then accountably infinite collection of other states that are obtained from this state by flipping spins in finally many, many places. And mutatis mutandis for Mary, and mutatis mutandis for Mr. Ed, but because, yeah. Okay. So, this makes the question that we need to answer to finish building our quantum theory once we found a representation of the canonical commutation relation, anti-commutation relation, the Pauli relations for the infinite split chain, the question of which limits of polynomials of canonical magnitudes are also magnitudes, fraught. If you're going to take the uniform topology as the adjudicator of which sequences have limits, well, everyone, Paul, Mary, Mr. Ed, they're all going to agree about what the observables are. But their agreement's going to constitute a picture of the magnitudes of the quantum theory that makes them impoverished with respect to what we might have been conditioned to expect by the finite case. In the finite case, give me commutation relations, you sentence me to the algebra of bounded operators on a Hilbert space is my algebra. If Paul follows the recipe for building his algebra of observables using uniform limits as criterion of the uniform topology is the criterion of convergence, he's going to wind up with a strictly smaller algebra. Missing from it, it's going to be things like this global magnetization observable. Having wound up with a strictly smaller algebra and applying sanity criteria for what counts as a state on that algebra, he's going to wind up with a strictly larger set of states. Okay, so already, if you think the right answer, which limits of sequences of magnitudes in your store of magnitudes are also magnitudes, is the answer uniform limits. You're getting a picture of what it is to be a quantum theory that's different from the picture in the finite case. However, you're getting a bad picture, a picture that's not going to work, a picture that's not going to foster projects of physics you might use theories like this to pursue. And suppose part of what you wanted to do with models like the infinite spin chain or much more elaborate, better ones, is understand ferromagnetism. Then it seems like you'd want in your arsenal observables the kind of order parameter that tells you what the difference is between a paramagnetic state, where your iron bar isn't magnetized at all, and different ferromagnetic states, maybe where there's a magnetic field in this direction, a magnetic field in that direction. So you might take your explanatory goal, if you're trying to do quantum physical mechanics for and make sense of ferromagnetism, to recognize at certain critical temperatures multiple distinct equilibrium states where the differences between them consist in the different expectation values they assign this magnetization observable. This explanatory goal in itself is inducement to go to the thermodynamic limit, because short of the thermodynamic limit, the Gibbs equilibrium state is unique for fixed dynamics at a fixed temperature. So short of the thermodynamic limit, you're just not going to have the sort of phase structure that consists in multiple distinct equilibrium states. So you gotta go to the thermodynamic limit to get this very possibility. But prosecuting your quantum theory as guided by the answer, the only limits that count are uniform limits at the thermodynamic limit, doesn't really help you much. It doesn't help you much because, as already observed, this order parameter, this phase observable, this thing that characterizes the explanandum by saying how different phases are different, isn't going to be in your collection of magnitudes. Okay, so that's an answer, it's a clear answer, it's a defensible answer, it's an answer that disables physics. Other answers, I'm gonna start hurrying because I'm running out of time. You might use more permissive criteria of convergence for constituting an algebra of observables. You might say, okay, let's take weak limits, uniform limits, we don't get all the magnitudes we want, let's take weak limits. Then the question's going to be, we saw that Paul and Mary and Mr. Ed agreed both about whether the finite chain magnetization converged at all in the limit as n goes to infinity. They also disagreed about what it converged to. So if your account of what it is to be a quantum theory of the infinite spin chain invokes the weak topology as a criterion of convergence, you're going to have to answer the question, weak convergence according to whom? Is it up to Paul? What sequences converge? Is it up to Mary? Is it up to Mr. Ed? You're going to get different theories depending on how you answer the question. If you let, say you have some reason for thinking, you know, Mary's on to the truth about these bars, you let her answer the question. You get something that looks like a quantum theory for finitely many systems. You get the algebra of observables being the full collection of bounded operators on her Hilbert space, and the density operators being the states. You get among the collection of observables you recognize this all-important phase observable, but there's a price. The price is, according to Mary, the phase observable only ever has one value. Every state in Mary's Hilbert space is a state where the global polarization is one in the minus z direction. So on this strategy, we have the magnitude that distinguishes distinct equilibrium states, but we lack the distinct equilibrium states to distinguish. So this is the last bit of the first part of my talk. So it seems like the thing you need to do is just exercise judgment. Any kind of blanket policy for building a quantum theory seems either to disenfranchise important magnitudes or to rule out of existence necessary states. So it's a kind of picture here of what a quantum theory is for purposes of making sense of ferromagnetism, where you sort of paste together the observables you get associate with privileged states. And like I said, insofar as that approach to constituting the content of a quantum theory sort of changes the ground rules, sort of makes the theory you wind up with something that you're not sentenced to by the canonical commutation relations, but something you sort of construct within bounds set by those relations. What it is to be a quantum system, what it is to be within the ambit of a quantum theory seems to have changed at the thermodynamic limit. That's the thing I said was sort of interesting. I want to close by looking quickly at arguments that there's no way anything you say about the thermodynamic limit could ever be sort of interesting. So Craig Callender in 2001 wrote a paper called Taking Thermodynamics Too Seriously, where he wants to be sort of dismissive of getting too excited about peculiarities of the thermodynamic limit. What he opts for instead is just because, you know, our cup of coffee is literally finite, just because our cup of coffee has only finitely many systems in it, it must be that the right thing to say about the interesting thermodynamic behavior of a cup of coffee is something you can say in a thermodynamics or system mechanics involving only finitely many systems. So instead of the discontinuities that signal phase transitions to the rest of us, Callender would look for a statistical mechanics that understands phase transitions in terms of not literal discontinuities, but really sharp slopes in the thermodynamic functionals. John Ehrman sings a similar tune. Don't get too excited about the thermodynamic limit, because the thermodynamic limit is less than an idealization. And he articulates a sound principle of interpretation. Idealizations are useful, even essential, but a sound principle of interpretation would seem to be that no effect can be counted as a genuine effect if it disappears when the idealizations are removed. So what they're saying is, I call it the poo-poo argument, the kinds of conclusions people might want to draw about emergence or about what it is to be a quantum system on the basis of what happens at the thermodynamic limit shouldn't be taken seriously. So the thermodynamic limits and idealization, cups of coffee are finite. The sorts of things we get excited about, they're they rest on the idealization. We don't really need the idealization. There's probably some future theory of statistical mechanics that doesn't need n to go to infinity. So this peculiar structure we're making so much to-do about isn't going to be with us forever, so it's without foundational interest. This is my closing point. What I want to say about the poo-poo argument is that it rests on a guess about the future of physics. Like people have been saying all along, all theories are effective theories. To get this argument to work, you have to guess that the future of physics includes a future of physics where what we need to say about phase phenomena, we can manage to say using finite statistical mechanics. Physics might develop that way. That's possible. But you might want to make another guess about the future of physics. There's all kinds of guesses about the future of physics, but here's another guess. Future and better, improved accounts of phase transitions and other critical phenomena will share with the thermodynamic limit features macro properties. Notice that the magnetization observable is observable different from a multiple identity that has a dispersion-free value in every pure state of the system. That's an interesting new kind of observable phase coexistence made available in the thermodynamic limit. One reason to think that the features of the thermodynamic limit that enable us to accommodate model critical phenomena are features that will persist in future theories of physics, maybe the underlying way you build the theory to get the features will change, but the features will persist, is some of these very same features help sort of set an explanatory agenda for physics. Why do so many different systems have the same critical exponents? And they trigger techniques used for sort of pursuing that explanatory agenda. Okay. So I want to close by juxtaposing Ehrman's sound principle of interpretation with my own sounder principle of interpretation. We're not doing final physics. No effect, my sounder principle, is no effect predicted by a non-final theory can be counted as a genuine effect if it disappears and stays disappeared from all the theory successors. This is a really good principle for deciding what counts, except for it's totally impracticable to apply this principle meaningfully. We need to be prescient. But that's okay, somebody once said, philosophy is the history of future science. Part of what philosophers are up to, especially the metaphysical ones, is guessing how science is going to go. Craig and John are guessing differently from other people. That's as it should be. Thank you.
Questions? Editor? Rob?
I think I'm pretty confused about what the points being made are supposed to be. It's very common in physics to make idealizations that that correspond to taking some idealized limit that isn't going to be actually realized by any system. I mean, just as another example, just to have something in mind. I mean, in general relativity, there's no notion of gravitational energy density, really, that makes any sense, or energy carried by gravitational radiation. But you can make this idealization of an asymptotically flat space-time. And in that idealization, you can introduce null infinity, and there you can make a precise definition that really makes mathematical sense of, you know, flux of gravitational energy, or, you know, Bondi mass, let's say, and things like that. Now, it would seem to me the issue is that something useful to do? And I think the idea of introducing this notion of null infinity in general relativity is very useful. The idea of taking the thermodynamic limit in statistical physics is extremely useful. It would be incredibly awkward, to talk about, you know, gravitational radiation from the binary pulsar, even though our space-time is not asymptotically flat. It, you know, goes to some cosmological space-time. We can't really define, but, you know, it's obvious. So I think I'm missing probably the main point. I mean, I don't see how anyone could question whether introducing a thermodynamic limit is useful any more than questioning whether introducing the concept of asymptotic flatness in general relativity is useful.
Yeah.
And, you know, it certainly makes sense to describe phenomena in non-asymptotically flat space times like the one we live in, and for finite, large but finite systems in terms of these concepts that only make sense, really precise mathematical sense, in the idealized limit. I mean, but so what is the, I mean, do you agree with what I'm saying? And then if you do, what is the issue that remains?
Right. So I absolutely agree. The issue that remains is whether these expedients, no question they're useful, but are they just expedients? Are the kinds of representational capacities the expedients make available, do they correspond to what the world is like? Is there any way where in nature, not in our treatment of nature afforded by taking the thermodynamic limit, but in nature itself, like literal strict discontinuities? Or is the idea that in nature there's literal discontinuities an artifact of this expedient? So it's not a question about expedience. It's a question about the interpretive weight to put on the structures made available by pursuing the expedients.
I mean, so in general relativity, we can't define a notion of gravitational energy carried by gravitational radiation.
That seems like a very good reason to do the pay attention to the idealized situations where that concept makes sense. That's a matter of sort of cleaning up concepts. But some idealizations sort of can be read to give pictures of what the physical world is like. And the issue is, nobody argues the idealizations are very useful. The issue is whether, when the pictures are made available on account of the idealization, should we take the pictures literally, or should we withhold judgment, or even go one step further and guess when we get a...
Can we move that to later discussion and just take a quick question?
Can I ask a question which I think is to some extent related to Bob's? If I take the question you just asked literally, I mean, are there any systems in nature that are described realistically by the thermodynamic limit? As a physicist, I can unambiguously answer no. And there's a reason for that. It's that at some energy scale, there will always be long-range interactions in the system, which mean that there is no thermodynamic limit. So if I take a set of spins of the kind that you talked about, you never wrote down a Hamiltonian for them, but in reality, there are dipolar interactions between those spins, which are long range, which mean that the distribution of magnetic field and magnetization in that body will depend on its shape, no matter how big it is. So there is no thermodynamic limit. What you get depends on the shape of the object as you let the thing get big. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this is just a specific example of the more general feature of nature, which is that we have long-range interactions everywhere. Nature is described by gauge theories, and they inevitably mean long-range interactions. But when experimentalists want to check out some of the really extraordinarily precise predictions made by phase transition theory, which assume a thermodynamic limit, well, they don't go and do the experiments on blocks of spins. They go to something like, say, helium-4 superfluid, where they can get to within 10 to the minus 12 degrees of the phase transition. And then, of course, they have problems because there's a difference in gravitational potential across the sample, and so they want to send it into space and so on. But the point is that the idealization is useful up to a point, and that point is where these other terms become important, and the experimentalists will attempt to reduce them as much as possible. And so far, we've no reason to believe that that gives wrong answers.
Right. Yes. So it is a related question, and I'm going to give make a related point. So the question isn't whether there's a thermodynamic limit or not. The question is whether the sorts of possibility structures that become evident of the thermodynamic limit, discontinuities, for instance, are correspond to natural processes, or whether they're just artifacts of the idealization. And the art of the experimentalists might help us fine-tune our answer to the question of whether the kinds of phenomena that thermodynamic limit enable us to predict are out there. But yeah, I mean, part of what I'm saying is, physics is still under construction. You're describing some of the mechanisms for the construction of physics, and this question: does the expedient of taking the thermodynamic limit make available possibility structures that correspond to nature? Nobody knows the answer to that question because nobody knows if there even is a right full story about nature.
We should close the discussion now and take it over later.
Thank you.